This recording of Dr. Peter Gentry is from a one-day conference hosted by Grace Fellowship Church, Don Mills, in October 2014. For more information on the church, please visit gfcdonmills.ca. The material for the conference was taken from Dr. Gentry's work with Stephen Wellum, published in the book titled Kingdom Through Covenant. To learn more about any of the things Dr. Gentry teaches, please pick up a copy of the book and begin your investigation there. We hosted this conference and make the audio available for free because we believe that sound biblical theology is necessary for the health of every Christian and each local church. May God bless you as you explore His Word.
We've looked at the covenant that God made with Adam and Eve at creation. And we see that very quickly this goes down the tubes. In chapter 3, they violate the covenant relationship. There's a loss of commitment, of loyalty, of love, of trust, and obedience. And this turns the whole world into chaos and death. We saw then that God makes a new start with Noah. Noah is a new Adam, and the flood is a new creation. God gives him a brand new creation, and we see that this story also ends in chaos and death. Very quickly, we see the story of the drunkenness of Noah. Very difficult story to understand, but the clear message is things are going badly. We see that the human partner is unfaithful in the covenant relationship. And we see that this ends in Genesis 10 and 11. The humans decide to make a tower like our Toronto needle reaching to heaven. It's an example of human arrogance and independence from God. We want to do things independently of God. We want to live our own lives. We want to decide for ourselves what is right and wrong. That's what it means to know good and evil. I will decide for myself what is good and right and what is wrong. And this ends up with the whole world, with all the nations lost and scattered over the face of the earth. So the earth has returned to chaos. The earth started in chaos when God began His creative work. It turned back to chaos now for the second time. And so in this situation comes Abraham and the covenant with Abraham. There is a parallel in the literary structure because obviously, Adam and Eve had a lot of children that aren't mentioned in the Bible, but the first story is about a man with three sons. The next story is about another Adam, Noah. He had three sons. And then the next story is about another man who had three sons, Terah, had three sons. So you see, the author wants you to make a parallel, and he wants you to see that Abraham is another Adamic figure. God is making a new start. It's a different kind of new start. And this is actually the interpretation of the Apostle Paul. It's not the interpretation of Peter Gentry. Because if you look in Romans 4, verse 17, as it is written, this is God speaking to Abraham, I have made you the father of many nations. And Paul says, in the presence of the God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead, and calls into existence the things that do not exist. What does that last sentence remind you of? Where does God call into existence the things that do not exist? This is the creation story. When God says, let light be, and light was. So Paul's making a comparison between Abram and the creation story. Do you see that? Paul sees Abram as a new Adam. God is making another new start. And Just as in the creation story, God will bring something out of nothing, so in the Abrahamic story, he will bring something out of nothing. When you read the Hebrew text, you will clearly see that Sarah was at least 25 years after menopause. That's very clear in the Hebrew text. And she didn't enjoy sex. That's very clear in the Hebrew text. And so 25 years after that, God gave them a baby, and that's bringing something out of nothing. That's giving life to the dead. Their bodies are dead. That's bringing something out of nothing. So Abraham's story is a story of new creation. Abram becomes the father of a whole nation called Israel. And I want you to see that Abraham and his family Israel inherit the role of Adam and Eve by following the word blessing. Blessing, fruitful, and multiply. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Now in chapter 12, speaking to Abraham, I will bless you and make your name great. Be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Chapter 17, 2, 6, and 8, I will make my covenant between me and you, will multiply you exceedingly. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. Chapter 22, 16, because you have done this, I will certainly bless you and greatly multiply your descendants. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. 26:3, the Lord said to Isaac, I will be with you and will bless you. I will multiply your descendants. By your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. 26:24, fear not, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. 28:3, Isaac blessed Jacob and said, God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you. 35:11, God said to Jacob, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations will come from you. Did you hear that? Not only a nation, but a company of nations. That's why you're here today, a company of nations. Israel gained possessions in Egypt and were fruitful and multiplied exceedingly. 48:3, Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. So just by following the word blessing, fruitful, and multiply through the book of Genesis, we see that these are all key moments in the plot structure. Abraham's call, his circumcision, the offering of Isaac, the transition from Abraham to Isaac, from Isaac to Jacob, and the dwelling, the sojourn in Egypt, the narrative quietly makes the point that Abraham and his family inherit, in a measure, the role of Adam and Eve. The differences, however, are not insignificant, except for two places. The command, be fruitful, has turned into a promise. I will make you fruitful. The word exceedingly is added. And most importantly, possession of the land of Canaan and supremacy over enemies has taken the place of the dominion over the whole creation. We could sum up this aspect of Genesis by saying that Abraham's children are God's true humanity and their homeland is the new Eden. This is also pointed out in Exodus 15:17, but you will have to check the book to see that. So Abram and his family, later called Israel, Abraham is, as it were, a last Adam. God made a new start with Noah. Now he's making a new start with Abraham. And there are no new major beginnings after this in the Bible until we come to the new creation at the end of the Bible. Paul recognizes Jesus Christ as the last Adam because he's thinking the way I am, or better, I'm thinking the way he is, and he sees that Jesus is Israel. He is the seed of Abraham. That's why he calls Abraham the last Adam, because he reads the Old Testament this way. It doesn't come out of thin air. He was a good student of the Bible. When we see that Israel is, according to the Old Testament, the last Adam, and as later Jewish tradition understood it, the one undoing the sin of Adam, we see the background for Paul's understanding of Christ as the last Adam. Because as history unfolds, Jesus accomplishes in his person and work what God intended for Israel as a people. Now, in the stories in Genesis 11 through 26, there's a lot of information about Abraham. Four episodes in particular are very important: chapter 12, chapter 15, chapter 17, and chapter 22. Chapter 12 is where God gives promises to Abram. Chapter 15 is where God makes a covenant with Abram. Chapter 17 is where God confirms and upholds that covenant. God fulfills his obligation. And chapter 22, God adds an oath, and he swears with an oath just to make Abraham feel comfortable that he was going to fulfill all of his promises. Once again, God is communicating in the language of that time and in the cultural setting of that time, as we will see. So we're going to quickly go through these texts: Genesis 12, Genesis 15, and not so much time for 17 and 26. You have to, I guess, read the book, or hope that maybe the abridgment might lead you somewhere. You know, the bottom line is this: the Bible is a very big book. And it's like one of these big novels, like Les Miserables or The Count of Monte Cristo, 1,100 pages, 1,200 pages, 1,300 pages. And when you read a novel that long, that involved, it's very exciting at the end. And what we Christians want to do is we want to tear out the last chapter and share that with somebody else. And we're surprised that they're not excited as we are. And it's because they don't know the first 1,000 pages, which is what I'm doing for you today. Now, when we look at Genesis 12, 1 to 3, this is like a boy meets girl. Boy meets girl, they get to know each other, and as they spend some time together, they come to this conclusion: they would like to spend the rest of their life together. So you have an engagement. This is the giving of the promise. And then after a while, they get married. This is the making of the covenant. This is the making of the covenant. Some people like to reaffirm their vows on their 25th wedding anniversary. That's chapter 17, reaffirming your vows. Just a kind of a way for you to grab hold of the story. Let's read verses 1 to 3. And Yahweh said to Abram, "Go from your country and from your relatives and from your father's household." The father's household is the extended family, okay, which we don't understand very well in the Western world, but I'm sure a lot of you people do. "To the land which I will show you, and I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great." Now, here's a problem in the translation. The next statement is, "Be a blessing." This is a command form. It is not a future tense. You shall be a blessing. I don't know why the English translations do this. I'm not responsible for the English translations. But Any beginning student of Hebrew in only one semester can tell you this is a command form. And so it's a command, be a blessing. And I will bless the ones who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the clans or families of the earth will be blessed. What I want you to see here is there's a very clear literary structure. Surprise, surprise, we're starting with a literary structure. And what you see here are two commands. Go in verse 1 and be a blessing at the end of verse 2. Does everyone see that? Each command is followed by three promises. The command go is followed by three promises. I will make you into a great nation. That's number 1. I will bless you. That's number 2. And I will make your name great. That's number 3. Then you come to the second command, be a blessing. This is also followed by three promises. I will bless the ones who bless you. It's stated positively. Now it's stated negatively, but the one who curses you, I will curse. And then in case you didn't get the message, it's repeated for the third time. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. The two commands divide these promises into two parts for a good reason. The first three promises are only for Abram. Christians have a song and they sing, "Every promise in the book is mine." This is not true. These promises are only for Abram. They're not for anybody else. But look at the last three promises. These are for the whole world in terms of our relationship to Abram and his family. I will bless the ones who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's where we come in. All of the nations of the earth are going to be blessed in connection with Abraham and his family. We don't know how that's going to work out. It's like the Hunger Games. This is really suspenseful. And you're on the edge of your seat. You're going to be there for another 2,000 years. There's really no story like this one. So the first promise is that Abram will be a great nation. Now you can't become a great nation without land. See, it's very simple. When two people get married, sometimes children come along. And do you think they're going to sleep in your bedroom for the rest of their lives? So you need more space. Babies mean you need more space. So the promise of descendants includes the idea of land, and that is made very clear in verse 7. Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So there are two parts to the promises. There's the promise of descendants or seed and the promise of land. We see that Abram is performing as an Adamic figure, because he's acting like a priest and he's acting like a king. I'm going to show you that. In verses 8 and 9, he advanced from there toward the mountains east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and with Ai on the east, and he built an altar to Yahweh, and he called out in the name of Yahweh. And Abram was tenting towards the Negev. In the Abrahamic stories, we see two things: his altar and his tent. The altar shows that he's a priest worshiping God. This is the only occurrences of altar in the story to this point are with Noah and with Abraham. There is no word in this narrative that is not motivated. Are you getting that picture? Read the text carefully. Every word is there for a reason. So We're told that there's an altar because the author wants us to see that he's functioning as a priest, and he's calling out in the name of Yahweh. The tent simply tells us that he hasn't arrived at the promised land yet. He hasn't been able to settle down. The second promise given to Abram is blessing. I'll return to that in a moment. The third promise is that God will make Abram's name great. And as we see later in the Bible, David has a great name. So having a great name is something that is common for kings. If you've ever read any history, we know the names of most kings, but not the name of Joe Smith or Joe Blow or whatever we call him in Canada, Johnny Canuck. All right. So the promise of a great name actually means that Abraham is a kingly figure. Do you see that? Although Abram is never called a king, the king of Gerar treats him as an equal. The inhabitants of Hebron call him a prince of God, and he beats up other kings. So he's acting like a king. Genesis 14 tells the story where he beats up the four bad boys from the east. He stages a dramatic rescue, attacking the four kings at night with only 318 men from his household and his Amorite allies, Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol. As Abram returns from his victory over the four kings, he is met by two kings, the king of Sodom and the king of Salem, that is, the king of Jerusalem. These two kings represent two different kinds of kingship. The king of Sodom represents the idea that you acquire goods and rule goods by might. You rule by might. So if you can grab it, it's yours. Might makes right. It is the normal pattern of kingship in Canaan and has been from that time down to the present day. An absolute ruler uses his position to aggrandize himself. Melchizedek, the king of Salem, represents a different kind of kingship. He acknowledges a supreme God who is creator or possessor of everything. Therefore, every ruler must acknowledge a higher power than him, the Most High God. Every ruler must consider that everything one owns is a gift from this creator. He is a servant of the Most High God. His kingship is based on the worship of this God. Abram does three things. He identifies the Most High God as Yahweh. He gives a tenth to Melchizedek, so he shows that he's siding with Melchizedek. And he refuses to receive any of the spoils of war. The big-hearted king of Sodom says, "You take the stuff and give us the people." Was it his right as a conquered person to say that? Generally, it's the conquerors who have the right to say, "I'll do what I want with the people and the stuff." But Abram said, "I don't want any of this stuff." So we see here that there's a servant kind of kingship, and there's a kind of kingship that grabs everything for oneself. And the kind of kingship that God is calling Adamic figures to is a servant kind of kingship. In the second group of promises, we see that God promises to bless those, notice in the plural, who bless Abram. Second, it's stated negatively, God will curse the one who treats him lightly. Why does he bless in the plural and curse in the singular? Because God has such a big heart, he wants to bless many people and curse few. Most people in Toronto don't know God. They don't know his heart. He wants to bless many and curse few. And he says in the end that in Abraham's seed, all of the families of the earth will be blessed. Summarizing quickly, Did you notice that in verses 1 to 3, we have the word bless 5 times? The word curse occurs 5 times, and only 5 times, in the first 11 chapters. So the author is telling us that everything is now going to be turned around with Abram and his family. God is going to save the whole world through Abram and through his family. There is a causal relationship between the first 3 promises and the last 3 promises. Why does God want to bless Abram? So that Abram can have all this stuff and be a great man? No, so that he can be a blessing to the whole world. If you know the Middle East, and I'm thinking of the ancient Near East, in the ancient Near East there were 2 superpowers. There was Egypt in the west and Mesopotamia in the east, ruled at times by Assyrians and at other times by Babylonians. And most of the space in between is desert. And the simple truth is, when you cross the desert, you die. So there's a skinny little piece of land that connects these 2 superpowers. It's the land of Canaan. It's 35 kilometers wide and 90 kilometers long. So it's only as wide as the city of Toronto. Did you realize that? And this is where God is going to put his family. You see, Canaan is the spine of the internet in the ancient world. All of the commerce and trade from these 2 superpowers has to go through this one tiny little place. And when they do, they're supposed to see a group of people who have a right relationship to God, who treat each other in truly human ways, who know how to be good stewards of the earth's resources. That's what's supposed to happen. A last quick comment about Abram and the city of God. The first promise is, I will make you into a great nation. The last promise is, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Most translations have families. It's a Hebrew word that means clans. A clan is a kin group between the extended family and the tribe. So it could have as many as 14,000 people in it. I suppose it might be a bit like a Scottish clan. But it's simply an amorphous kin group that has no structure or governmental headship. Goy is the word for nation. And this is very interesting because in the Old Testament, Israel is always called Am, people, and almost never called Goy, nation. The reason for that is that Am is a kinship term. Because of the covenant at Sinai, Yahweh and Israel get married, and they're family. Marriage is a very interesting legal fiction, because when you get married, somebody who is not your relative is now closer than any of your blood relatives. One of the good things in Canada is that we still have meals at weddings. This is dispensed with in the United States. They have a few snacks, but that's it. So it's hardly worth attending a wedding. Do you know why you have a meal? Because in the ancient Near East, you only eat with family. You don't eat with people who aren't family. And so after you get married, this person who is now closer to you than any other family member, the first thing you want to do is to show that by eating with them. This isn't just the Bible, it's all across the ancient Near East, but we don't know anything about the Bible in Canada, so this is a problem. So why does God say that to Abram that he's going to make him into a great nation? Why doesn't he say, I'm going to make you a great people? Because the normal term is people. And why doesn't he call the other people groups in the world nations? This text is quoted 6 more times, and in 5 of those times it says nations, not clans. You know why? Because a nation is a group of people who are organized with government, with headship, with societal structure. It's a group of people that are going somewhere. It's a kingdom. And God is saying, Abraham and his family is a kingdom. This is the group of people that's going somewhere. All of the other people groups in the world are amorphous kin groups that are going nowhere. They're not real kingdoms that are going to last. So the author to the Hebrews was absolutely right, because the way you communicate this in Greek is by the word city. We think of a city as a place that's highly populated, as opposed to the country, which is sparsely populated, but that's not the meaning of the word city in Greek. A city is a group of people who have a government and structure and headship, and they have societal structure. It's a kingdom. We should translate the word polis in Greek by city-state. So you see, the author to the Hebrews was right. Abraham looked for a city whose builder and maker is God. He could actually understand what this text was saying. The idea of the city and the kingdom is right here in this text. Let's move now to Genesis 15. We're going till quarter after. So I guess we have 10 minutes for 15 and 10 minutes, 5 minutes for 17 and 5 minutes to wrap up. We'll see how this works. Obviously, this is an advertisement for the book. One of the people here said, "Do you sell the book?" And I said, "No." But you can see that that's a lie. You see? All right. We're just trying to help people. I've been struggling most of my life, and these are some of the answers I think God has given me, and I hope they're helpful for you. We start with Genesis 15, and surprise, surprise, we start with a literary structure. This chapter is divided into 2 parts, and each part repeats itself. Surprise, surprise. Because Hebrews always repeat themselves. So in verses 1 to 6, God reveals himself in verse 1 and makes promises. In verses 2 and 3, Abraham gives a complaint and a question. And in verses 4 to 6, God reveals himself and confirms his promises. This is about descendants. Then in verses 7 to 19, God reveals himself and makes promises. In verse 7. Then in verse 8, Abram has a complaint and a question. And in verses 9 to 19, God reveals himself and confirms his promises. So each half has identical structure. Do you see that? Just makes it easy to memorize. I seem rather electrified here. Okay. The Genesis 15:1 is not very well translated in the New International Version. Fear after these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abraham in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram. I am your shield and your exceeding great reward." I don't want to go all through the details. The best translation is, "I am your shield." End of sentence. New sentence. Your reward will be very great. Why is he saying these things? Because it says, after these things. After what things? After Abraham beat up the 4 bad boys from the east. Do you think they're going to take that sitting down? No, they're going to be back next year with bigger and better armies. They're going to spend the winter building their stuff. Okay? So, first of all, there is the fear of reprisal. And Yahweh says, "Don't worry about it, Abram. I'll take care of it this time." Secondly, you remember that Abraham took none of the spoils of war for himself. And God says, "I'm going to give you a reward." That this is the correct interpretation instead of God being his reward is clear. You don't even have to know Hebrew. You just have to read your text, because the very next sentence, Abram says, "What will you give me?" He doesn't say, "How will you be my reward?" He says, "What will you give me?" You know, if I'm going to be a great nation, I need at least one baby. Yahweh responds with another night revelation. Asking Abram to count the stars if he is able, he promises that Abram's descendants will be as numerous as the sand on the seashore or the stars of the night sky. At this point, all the Lord is doing is repeating the promise in grandiose terms. Yet Abraham believes him. And Yahweh accepts this as righteousness. Righteousness is conformity to a norm or standard, but it always operates in a covenant relationship. It's like my neighbors across the street, Jim and Carol. Jim smokes cigars, but he always does it outside. So I imagine the marriage works this way. Carol says to Jim, "You can smoke cigars, but you have to smoke them outside if you want to be married to me." So if Jim accepts that, if he believes her, that's righteousness in the relationship. And Abram actually accepted these incredible promises, and God counted that as they had a proper relationship. Then we see in the second half that God makes a covenant. The ceremony or ritual described here is very strange. Nonetheless, as verse 18 shows, God made a covenant with Abram. You always have to start with what's clear, what's very clear in the text. We have the standard expression to cut a covenant. The interpretation of this mysterious rite is much discussed. The ceremony of covenant making involves an oath in which covenant partners bring the curse of death upon themselves if they are not faithful to the covenant relationship and promises. Walking between the animals, cut in half, is a way of saying, "May I become like these dead animals if I do not keep my promise." We see a similar ceremony in Jeremiah 34. What happens here is weird, because God puts Abram into a deep sleep. And in the deep sleep, a smoking fire pot and a blazing torch pass between the pieces. What does this mean? Well, you have to interpret, you have to say, how would the first readers of this text understood this? Who were the first readers? Well, they were the people. Moses would have given these books to Israel on the plains of Moab just before they entered the land. So the first readers of this text were the people who had just come through the Exodus. What would a smoking fire pot and a blazing torch mean to them? Well, God appeared to Moses in a burning bush. He appeared on Mount Sinai in smoke and fire. And every day there was a cloud, a pillar of fire, and a pillar of smoke, one for the day and one for the night. There was a good reason for that. It was God's toddler training for his new son, because in the desert it can be 50 C in the day, and in the night it can be minus 30 C. So if you don't stay with the pillar by day or the pillar by night, you freeze or you fry. Do you see that? It's like a toddler. You tell them, "Don't go to the stove," but you pick them bodily up out of the way. So God was teaching Israel to obey him and trust him. Anyway, what we see here is that something incredible. Only God passes between the pieces. So we see here, God communicates to the people in a ceremony that they understand, an ancient Near Eastern covenant-making ceremony, but there's a tiny twist. Something happens that makes this different from every other ceremony in the ancient Near East. God guarantees both sides of the agreement. Unbelievable. And we know what that means, because the first two covenants have gone down the tubes. We know already in the plot structure that the human partner is not and cannot be faithful, don't we? So we know that God has to die to keep this promise. Some people reject this interpretation. How